This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 56. I'm delighted to welcome Rob Moffat, partner at Balderton Capital, to dive into the topic of venture capital and fintech. As I aim to present London FinTech in the round, I have been for a long time keeping my eye open for a friendly VC to have on the show. This has taken 2 years, would you believe? Viewed from Mars, you might think that this is curious given how the whole mainstream tech media is so focused on fundraisings, so-called valuations and fantasy animals with one horn, and the whole machismo around money. Viewed not from Mars, the VC sector globally is perhaps rather problematic. If this is a surprise to you, then I commend to your attention as an entry point Diane Mulcahy's 2014 Harvard Business Review article entitled "Venture Capitalists Get Well Paid to Lose Money." As a former VC herself, she knows where to direct the fire: high fees, illiquidity, and underperformance. As I recall, in the greatest tech boom ever in the US, the aggregate stats are something like that the average VC hasn't even returned to the investors the funds they raised in the first place, let alone got a carry check for the performance-related fee element. Furthermore, as we heard way back in LFP 008 with Richard Gould, the UK/European venture capital market was very thin indeed for most of the 20th century, the UK basically having had the originally government 3i as the only player for a long time, and returns were poor. Hence, we come across concepts like the funding gap in the UK. Set against this, virtually every fintech that scales needs VC money, without which there would be no boom at all. Equally, like in all industries, there are always some good players with a reputation for adding value. And it's from this angle that I was introduced to Balderton Capital, who are one of the real players in the London fintech scene. Rob also writes a lot on the industry. I commend his blog to your attention, which I'll link to in the show notes. He's on the board of 7 of Balderton's investments. Balderton's best-known investments in UK fintech are perhaps GoCardless and Nutmeg, and they invest around £20 million per annum into the scene. So net-net, Balderton are blue-chip players who are recommended by one of the investee companies to me and spend lots of dough on fintech. Above and beyond this, Rob is, finally, someone who's happy to talk on air about the reality of VC and fintech. Plenty of people will talk off-air, some of those nice guys too. As he joined the firm in 2009 from Google, he has experienced the fintech world from roots through shoots and now into a rather varied garden. There's plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Rob. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, actually, apart from the weather, but I moan about the weather so much on the show. There's this thing called SAD, as everybody probably knows, which stands for Seasonally Affected Depression. But I think in the UK now, which has had non-stop storms for 2 months, it should be Summer Affected Depression. And I mentioned your blogging. I did some blogging myself. I wrote an article a week for a year on marketing on a project called the Dow of Business Development, which was some great content that went particularly nowhere. It wasn't really the right place at the right time. On the other hand, you blog about fintech, which is the right place at the right time. And how do you do that? But I think you kind of, in my old-fashioned terms, you kind of cheat in that you write articles when you have something to say. I was doing it the hard way. I was doing the kind of like journalist's way, which is you've got so many column inches to write on Friday, so you write them.
And it used to be the way blogging worked, right? You had to have a regular user base. It was about getting the emails out, and you had to do it weekly or even daily, right?
A bit like the podcast. If I do that every now and then, I'll lose the audience.
Exactly. Whereas now, I think, because I blog on Medium, I think Medium allows you to cheat, that you can sort of get the occasional good, well-thought-through piece out, and it will still get some distribution, even if you're just sporadic, as I am. Right? You can see the blog. There's not a lot there, but I try to make sure it's thoughtful when it does go out.
Well, I think it's quality rather than quantity. I followed for a long time, going back to the marketing, Seth Godin, who has written, I can't remember, a daily blog or something crazy forever now, you know, as a result of which the average article probably isn't very good. But he's still very brilliant. And if you see one of his sort of one-hour talks on YouTube that he does periodically, you'll get the best of it. So what's your motivation for doing the blogging? Was it just out of interest? Was it sort of professionally related?
I think it helps me crystallize my own thoughts. I think the act of writing down really helps me think through what is next for insurance. Right? And the forcing factor of writing it down really helps me think it through in my own mind. And I think it helps entrepreneurs get a better view on me as a VC. Otherwise, we have these one-hour coffee chats and we spend 58 minutes talking about their business and 2 minutes at the end where I try to squeeze in why Balderton is exciting, answer all their questions and tell them something about me. This gives them a chance to actually, in a relaxed way, learn a bit more about me as a person.
Yeah, so hopefully the podcast will do that for you. James Sherwin-Smith was on the podcast a few episodes ago, and I received an email from him today, like I do from most of the people who have been on the show, and he was happened to be talking to some South African businessman who had listened to the podcast with him, and therefore had some good feel of what he was like in the first place. Yeah. You know, and then you could sort of fast forward through the first 15 minutes, because it's straight into, so actually you believe that insurance fintech's going somewhere. Well, that's a bit strange, because I don't, but when you said so-and-so, you know.
Yeah, really exactly. Right.
So as a career dating service, and maybe I should reinvent the London Fintech podcast as a career dating service.
So yeah, what carry would you like?
Oh, yes, you see, you can tell you're talking to a VC. I didn't even think about money. Well, I shall have to come and take some lessons, actually. I shall take some lessons. So talking about your career journey, once upon a time, as I was noticing on LinkedIn, you did lots of sums at university, and you got most of them right by the looks of it. And you're now a sort of VC, and there was a little bit in the middle. How did that all work out?
A little bit of a random walk, as these things often are. So, yeah, studied maths and statistics. Did a master's, realised that, yeah, I'd hit the wall, that to go on to have a career in maths, you need to be a certifiable genius, and that wasn't me.
And putting that into context for the many people who don't know where you were, you did maths at Cambridge, which is the place to do maths. I mean, I'm biased in favour of Cambridge, but there are some extremely bright people doing maths at Cambridge.
It's intimidating. So while I was there, I spent an internship at GCHQ, which is the British version of the NSA, trying to break codes, which was a humbling experience. So yeah, entirely beyond me, but fascinating. So decided at that point, okay, I've got to get a job that earns real money, and that meant the business world, and I wanted something completely open-ended, and so chose strategy consulting. I went to Bain & Company, did that for 5 years, and they sponsored an MBA, which was very kind of them, and I took that kind gesture and went back for the minimum amount of time after my MBA and then departed.
And what did you learn from your MBA? I mean, different people seem to take away different stuff, really. I mean, okay, there's the content, but then there's the human being bit.
I think human element was certainly something that, yeah, I did a course in psychology, which was sort of dressed up as psychology and management, but effectively was a course in psychology, and that was probably the most interesting thing I did. And how do you really get to the bottom of someone and start to understand them as a person? So I think that on one side, and then microeconomics, which I didn't study at all at university, I found fascinating, just the concepts of it and how it relates to business strategy. And the reality is a lot of it's about the network, but I did actually learn a lot on the way.
Oh, interesting. And so then you moved on from Bain.
Moved on from Bain. I was looking around and always loved the tech sector, always fascinated by that. And Google was starting to really ramp up in Europe at the time. This was 2007. So I interviewed for Google. They had 200 people in London. And by the time I joined, they had 500 about 3 months later. So it was a kind of fascinating time to jump aboard the Google ship. Ended up being quite a tumultuous time. So I joined. The stock price, this was pre-stock split, was $500. Went down to 300. Slowly crawl back up to 500, at which I left. So my net impact on Google was zero.
And which year did you leave Google?
I left in 2009.
Someone I know who was in the city at a large bank that should remain nameless had enough of banking a couple of years ago and actually ended up getting a kind of management consultancy gig at Google in London, which would be whatever we're talking in 2014, 15 probably. And I saw her a few months later and she ran away screaming. I said, how was it? So it was complete anarchy. All these fiefdoms fighting.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's like a firm that's just grown like a weed kind of stuff. And, you know, you can all imagine. So before she was going there, she said, oh, look, you're really looking forward to it and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which just shows, coming back to the whole narrative of fintech scale-up that has, you know, been my general theme this year, which is that the name is just kind of a label, and what a startup is like is different from a scale-up, and it's different from a mega corporation. And
exactly. I mean, Google was desperately trying to preserve itself as an adolescent company and avoid becoming a slow Microsoft-like entity, and it's an uneasy balance to play. I think I learned a lot from that, kind of coming in and trying to be very structured and ordered, and what's the decision-making process, and the reality for Google is it probably went a little bit too far in that direction with the likes of Eric Schmidt and Nikesh Arora trying to turn it into a business. And the reality is it works best as a slightly anarchic organization where the sales and marketing people sort of chase along afterwards, doing what they can, following the sort of engineering machine.
Absolutely. So you've clearly had a very good career so far in surfing ahead of the wave, and therefore it's particularly impressive that you joined Balderton in 2009 to do fintech before fintech even existed, which shows how far-sighted you are. So how did you actually apply for a job which didn't exist at the time?
So yeah, the reality, I applied for a generalist role at Balderton, somehow persuaded them I knew something about venture capital and startups, having done neither of the above. But they thought that the Bain boot camp and then the kind of the Google learning would give me some ability to be a venture capitalist, which was very kind of them. Yeah, and joined late 2009. Spent the first year wondering what the hell I'd done and having zero confidence in my ability to find an interesting investment. And slowly built that confidence and hopefully a bit of an eye over time. And yeah, I think from the early days, looked at a few payments companies. That's before fintech, VCs invested in payments. And so we invested in a company called eWise. We looked at a bunch of other things in the payment space. And so started looking at that. And then I guess 3 years ago, there was this explosion of all sorts of other types of financial businesses to invest in and start going really deep in the sector then.
So from your perspective, when did you kind of come across the word fintech or the phenomenon as being fintech per se-ish?
That is a good question. I guess it was all about the peer-to-peer lenders and them starting to explode. So I'm going to guess 2012, 2013. It was really, 2014 was when it really took off.
Yes, 2014 was when it hit the media and PR companies.
Yeah, exactly, and you started creating quangos around it. Yeah,
absolutely, that's what I thought. I'm glad to meet someone else that thinks the same kind of thing. I've kept rather quiet about that. But in a gold rush, there's all sorts of people that turn up, and that'd be another podcast sometimes. When I hang up my podcasting boots on microphones, I shall do a sort of bitter and twisted episode where I include all the sort of gossip and things that I didn't actually mention over the time. So then, then we're into fintech. So before we come back to fintech more specifically in terms of fintech and VCing, which is the theme of the show, as I mentioned, the big picture situation of VC is very much sort of on the one hand, on the other hand, and on the other hand. So how do you see it from inside the industry?
So yeah, there's no dressing up the fact that the average performance of venture capital firms over time is poor. It's hard to argue with that. I think you can look at different date ranges, and I think we're at a stage now where we've had this huge boom over the last few years in the industry, but it hasn't crystallized into cash returns in a lot of cases. There's a lot of private companies out there. There's a lot of firms sitting on great asset values, kind of paper values for their portfolios, but it hasn't crystallized into cash. And so I think when that all comes through, I think the aggregate returns will look a lot better. But as with any area of asset management or active investment, there is a top quartile and there's a bottom quartile. And yeah, we think we are the top quartile firm in Europe, and there's a sort of attractive supply demand.
Yes, and then we were talking before about, again, about statistics, serial correlation, which is that just in normal investment management, you tend to find a firm will, for example, be very good at equities for a period of time and show good serial correlation, i.e. the past is a guide to the future. But then generally, or not generally, always, something changes in the market. I mean, perhaps the market's less bullish and going sideways, or growth stocks are out and value stocks are in, and that firm will fall away. So if you're out there trying to pick an active asset manager, which I gave up a long time ago, the past isn't always a guide to the future. I imagine, not trying to be soft or nice to you or anything like that, but I imagine that in VC, because you're not sitting there trying to decide whether BP is going to outperform Shell or whether oils are going to outperform banks in the next 6 months or other stuff that basically one can't know, but you are literally on the inside, which we'll come on to at the end of the show in terms of actually how you interact with fintechs. But because you're on the inside and because you have a process and knowledge and contacts and yardy, 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 I would imagine that the numbers might well show a greater serial correlation, i.e. that a good performing VC, as long as they don't do something stupid like raise 100 times the money and not have the infrastructure, is perhaps more likely to be a good VC going forward than, say, an equity fund manager is. Is this true?
No, I agree with that. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. And you look at the US, which has been doing VC at scale for a lot longer than Europe, and that's definitely true. I look at the returns of Benchmark, the returns of Sequoia. They have impressive serial performance that I think, even as a statistician, you can really rip apart. There is some genuine evidence of outperformance there, some genuine alpha. I think two things drive that. One is that I believe and I hope that talent does make a difference to being a good VC, that there is a science and an art in choosing which companies to invest in. And then there's a support that you can give companies that can give them a significant leg up versus other companies that are out there. And on the second side, more cynically, there is a reinforcing cycle. You become a preeminent venture capital firm in a city, in a country, then the best startups in that area will actively seek you out. And there's this reinforcing cycle that the best entrepreneurs find the best VCs who then are able to find the next generation of good entrepreneurs, and it puts you in a strong position.
Exactly, and starting with universities and having had John Kay on last episode, who'd formed the Oxford Business School and had a great stress around doing that. You can imagine a country, for example, whenever it was, whichever century, that invents a whole bunch of universities.
Yeah.
As you say, one will just end up being better than the others, and then the best candidates will go there.
Exactly, and it becomes
reinforcing. Yeah. That's an interesting context. So that's the way the world is, and that's where the good ones can come from. So what's the big picture then, Rob, about fintech and VC? And I say that because one of the differences perhaps of fintechs is that those that have started with Citi background or Citi mates, and I'm thinking particularly here of Market Invoice, for example, got a lot of their original capital by going round and tapping a dozen or so of their buddies for 50 grand a pop. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you've got a sort of bunch of traders and your friends, yeah. Or a lot more than that, exactly, you've got a few friends as traders, that will get you going. Vice versa, other people just try and do sort of friends and relatives and start with 10 grand or 100 grand or tiny sum of money. So maybe the VC introduction to the tech area comes at a slightly later stage than the average tech in London, or am I just completely making that up?
I think, so yeah, on average, yes. So look at when we've invested in fintech companies, it's tended to be a little bit later elsewhere. There's one exception, Business Revolut, that we invested in last year very early, and that got a little bit of angel money before, but very small. And yeah, we came in sort of pretty early in that. But if you take a Nutmeg, you take Prodigy Finance, Go Cardless, these were all kind of a bit later. And Nutmeg and Prodigy had raised millions of pounds from angels along the way and were able to do so, which I think is good, right? I think the early stage of a company, it makes sense to raise angel money. I think getting VC too early is often the wrong idea, because a VC only wants you to go one way. They want you to go towards the £1 billion plus valuation, and there may actually be a very nice £50 million exit for your company that you're then ruling that option out by taking VC too early on.
Yes, that's an interesting point. I mean, back in the day, there used to be, well, I mean, when I was at Klein Watson, I had some involvement where basically I decided how much the group capital went into venture capital, all that kind of thing. And so I did actually wrestle 20 years ago with the problem of how on earth you work out performance of something which isn't marked to market and has all the problems you mentioned. And in those days, we had a company called KBDC, the head of which actually ended up becoming the head of the BVC, the British Venture Capital Association. And that was KBDC was Clement Benson Development Capital.
Yeah.
So in those days, there was a terminology around the phases. You know, the startup capital is one kind of thing, and development capital is another, and venture capital is another, and private equity is another. And somehow, just to my perception, the boundaries seem to have dissolved, which doesn't actually help the perception of VCs or people trying to raise money. You know, you've got to go to the right kind of place. If you want a cheap off-the-peg suit, you go to Marks & Spencer. You don't go to Savile Row.
Yeah. Whereas those boundaries are broken down, right? You've got people raising £10 million rounds from high net worths or from crowdfunding platforms, and the advantage is definitely different, which is good in a way because it obliges you as a VC to say, okay, what is our value add versus just being money? And we can't rely on that anymore as our selling point, particularly in fintech when there's a lot of money around, not just from angels, but also from hedge funds and private equity firms dipping down and strategic money. There's a lot of money floating around, and so we need to justify why an entrepreneur should work with us. And I think part of that is the support we can give them, and I can go into more detail on that. And it's also someone who is going to be very engaged and is going to give them a hard time when they need a hard time. One of my partners says, when everything's going well, we need to be giving the entrepreneur a hard time. When everything's going badly, we're that support. We're trying to sort of be a oscillation minimization kind of device.
Interesting.
Whereas I think often business angels will play the reverse. When things are going well, they'll just be applauding. And when things are going badly, they will start wailing. Yeah.
Yes, it's interesting. You mentioned the billion thing, which leads me on to the thinking about the process around it and the assumptions. So if the London FinTech podcast is trying to sort of raise 10 million or something like that, you know, I'll come to you and I'll show you my sort of PowerPoint and spreadsheet and hockey stick and, you know, a whole bunch of projections and yardy, yardy, yardy. But kind of everybody knows, I think, on the scene, but vice versa, the VCs have got a whole bunch of assumptions in there, one of which is, as you imply, the general portfolio construction is along the lines of share the money out and hope one of them hits a billion, because a lot of them won't work and you can't actually tell the future that reliably in early stage, whether you're 1 year or 2 years, at 3 years. So how do you communicate that? I'm trying to raise 10 million. You say, okay, Mike, well, we'll give you five. You know, as long as you put a million in yourself and get four from someone else. But actually, from that, we're expecting an ROI of 99% or something. Or do you leave it for a few board meetings and then I suddenly have the chance at what's known in the UK as the Vicarage Maserati syndrome, which I heard from a well-known fintech in London, who actually did have a VC on the board. He was bemoaning to me last year over a beer the fact that actually he'd settle for the Vicarage and the Maserati. He'd settle for a very nice house in Devon and a nice car and not be able to work for quite a while. But actually his VCs would no longer let him because that wasn't good enough. So, you know, to an extent, he was then sort of chained into a sort of dialectic that he didn't really want in the first place. So clearly, in his particular case, his communications hadn't made it clear to him up front.
Yeah.
Which is, look, we'll give you this Wonga, but mate, you're not going out with the Vicarage and the Maserati. You know, you've got to go for gold.
Yeah, you've
got
to go for the yacht, And look, we try and be pretty clear up front. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for the the billion-dollar exit, and that's what we're going to push towards. And that's going to involve some risk along the way. And yeah, we invest in 30 companies over the lifetime of a fund over 3 years, and we expect two of them to be absolute kind of huge successes, and that for us drives all of our returns. So that's what we're shooting for. That being said, we've had a company bought by Twitter last week and a company bought by Microsoft last year. Both were Vicarage and Maserati. Well, no, they were more than that. They were kind of nine-figure exits, which for the entrepreneurs was fantastic. 100 million plus exits. And for our kind of minority stake, we have, say, 20% on average. For us, that's all very well and good, but a $20 million return in a $300 million fund is not getting us that far. It's all very nice, right? But I think for us, if the entrepreneur believes that is the best possible option for their company, then you just have to go with it, right? But that's not what we're aiming for. We're aiming to go an order of magnitude higher than that.
Yes, I mean, it depends on the construction of the board, of course, because the function of the board is to maximize the shareholder value.
Yeah.
And it's a phenomenon we're seeing quite a lot, which is that certain chief executives are good at starting things and making things happen and getting them growing. And
yeah.
Certain ones are good at expanding them, and certain one of them are good at sort of sitting in huge committee meetings that go on all afternoon with sort of 12 inches of bureaucratic paper. So actually, one of the answers to the story I was saying earlier could have been, you know, well, mate, it's time to move on. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't do that, no one's saying that you have to do that, I presume.
Yeah.
You know, there will be somebody who's sort of, you know, more of a maniac that wants to sort of go pedal to the metal and push on 10 times now and all that kind of
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and maybe it's a time for you to take your exit.
It's not the ideal for us. I think we love backing entrepreneurs and yeah. that kind of zeal that they have for their business, I think gives an increased probability of success. So when we invest, we're looking, okay, we're getting behind this entrepreneur or entrepreneurs and we want to go with them all the way. But you're right, sometimes it doesn't work out and 99% of the time that's amicably, and everyone realizes that the best thing is to bring in a new CEO, and 1% maybe it's not amicable.
Yes, that's always the way of the world. I mean, and the other point is that, you know, I don't think anybody gets anywhere in fintech, whether you're doing a podcast or whatever, without some sort of drive to push forward, otherwise
exactly.
you sort of give up. But I think what happens a bit like you were sort of saying about maths, that actually you reach a point where you're a bit knackered, you're a bit exhausted, and you know, you've pushed it on for 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years or whatever,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
you haven't got the beans anymore, you know. Maybe there's sort of family circumstances and a whole bunch of stuff, and then you just run out of gas, you know.
Yeah.
One morning you get up and you haven't got it anymore. So that's all part of the journey. So moving on then to sort of the fintech world, which so you write about quite a lot, just very briefly, because it's not a show on sort of fintech per se, what kind of things exciting you at the moment in 2016, and how do you think it's differing from 2015?
I think what I'm looking for now is new areas that aren't getting too crowded. So I look at peer-to-peer lending, or I look at lending in aggregate, and it's very hard to see original ideas at this point. And we're always seeking out original ideas here, and who's got a view on something that no one else has seen, or they've got a unique data source, or they've got a unique approach. And yeah, we're still seeing a lot of companies that are trying to do lending in a slightly better way with the latest machine learning algorithm, and that we struggle with. So what I'm excited by, I'm still excited by wealth management. We're invested in Nutmeg, but I think that's one take on it, and it's a successful one. But I think there's probably 10 other ways to get people to do wealth management in a more intelligent way. And I'd sort of lump in life insurance and pensions as part of that. So that's one area. And then the second area is insurance. And I think there's a huge amount that can be done in insurance, all the way from distribution and personal lines and the next generation of aggregators, all the way through to the underwriting of commercial lines for large businesses, and trying to sort of work out where are the niches there that a startup can insert himself in a world of incredibly big beasts. That's what I still spend most of my time thinking about.
That's interesting. I mean, in the last episode with John Kay, we were talking about the opportunities that you see in investment management, and that it hasn't really been touched very much. I mean, mentioning Nutmeg, as I mentioned on the show, John Kay was an investor in Nutmeg, as a coincidence as these things happen. And me as a 50-something and he as a 60-something, both felt that one of the biggest areas is not kind of, shall we say, just doing a new version of old-fashioned active asset management or passive asset management, but the biggest challenge to be solved, certainly for people of our generations, is the whole morass of rules and regulations around pensions and all that kind of stuff. My God, if you said to me, Mike, do you know what? I can actually give you some really good advice here.
Yeah.
On ISAs, pensions, life insurance, da-di-da-di-da-di. Wow.
Yeah.
I'd have that.
Yeah, yeah.
If you could say, oh, here's a nice GUI, which will help you buy ETFs a bit simpler. Yeah, I'll look at it sometime. And do you know what?
Yeah,
I'm a bit too busy to get around to it. So there were some really tricky problems and coming back to the show a couple of shows ago with Giles, I was talking about sort of FinTech 2.0 just as a label. I think that if we're going to see a new wave, and I think we're in need of a bit of a new wave of FinTechs, they are going to be tackling, coming back to the maths, some harder problems. Low-hanging fruit, as it were, you can pick by being there.
I sort of agree and disagree with that. I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit still out there. There's a lot of people who still use St. James's Place, and they're paying 5% buy-in, and they're paying 1.5% to 2% management fees, and they're getting absolutely fleeced, if you pardon my French. And they should be using Nutmeg or one of 10 other startup solutions. So I think there is some genuine low-hanging fruit out there. I think the harder problem is, how do you solve the advice gap? And I think what is really interesting is artificial intelligence is back in vogue, and it's back in vogue because it's actually starting to work. We've been laughing about artificial intelligence for 30 years.
I've been laughing at it since the 60s. In the 60s, I bought into the fact that it was a good thing and it was really going to go somewhere. And I ended up doing computer science. And, you know, when I interviewed graduates at Climewatts, one of them had been working on this. And like all the sort of interviewees that got to merchant banks, they were very bright, very sharp, very everything. Yeah. I completely clean-bowled this guy by saying, hasn't artificial intelligence really just been a complete disappointment for 20 years? Yeah. He had nothing to say because I took him outside of his box. If I stayed in the box, he'd have sort of, you know, locked me all around the court. So I've been sort of cynical ever since, and through neural networks and a whole bunch of stuff like that. I mean, neural networks very good at recognising number plates on sort of, you know, petrol stations so you can't drive off and all that. Having said that, I came across a great example recently where I thought, oh, okay, maybe, well, I wouldn't call this artificial intelligence, but I would call it sort of useful. There's some chat app or chat bot or something, which has helped, I can't remember, it was reported this week, 100,000 or 400,000 people get off parking fines.
Right, by walking through
them through a process or something simple like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And a lot of the bots are still quite simple. They're if-then statements.
Exactly, yes. It doesn't have to be sort of, you know, going back to Google, it doesn't have to be coming up with a program that's going to beat the Go world champion.
Yeah, exactly. But the reality of a lot of financial advice is it's if-then statements. It's just about assembling in the right order and taking the hits. It's a year of fairly boring work to understand all of tax legislation, and a lot of people are going to hit the cap on pension tax benefit in the UK, and I hypothesise 95% of them aren't aware of that. And that is a pretty simple statement. It's about how do you make that a joyful experience for someone to work out, as opposed to sort of sifting through 100 pages of HMRC documents, or sitting down for 2 hours with someone, a frightfully nice guy from the house down the road, who starts filling in forms and starts with your name and address and wants to recollect 12 months of payslips and then charges you an arm and a leg for it.
Yes, and you know, having been to a conference with those guys last year, those IFAs and financial advisors got a huge problem themselves. They're terribly worried about being beaten up and sued and all that kind of stuff these days,
exactly,
you know, all these mis-selling things.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
they're getting more and more conservative and actually retreating because of the pressure of regulation into becoming sort of if-then-else statements and everything sort of...
Exactly, yeah.
...derrière covered. So anyway, as always, there's plenty of opportunities out there. So moving on to the last bit of the FinTech VCing, Rob, could you just run us briefly through how it works from soup to nuts? So I'm trying to raise 10 million for the London FinTech podcast, no particular reason, but anyway, let's say I am. So what actually happens? I go around and knock on the door of a few people such as yourselves, and what happens from there to, you know, the day you're pushing me out as CEO? Or I've made a £1 billion unicorn out of a podcast.
Let's just focus on the latter. So I think what typically happens, I think it's very rare we invest in an entrepreneur we haven't got to know a bit beforehand. So we've probably been for coffee a couple of times over the last year and maybe longer. So we invested in Nutmeg. I'd known Nick Hungerford for probably 3 years before that, and just sort of catching up and how's it going? How was your latest ISA season? And they came in at a point, 2014, where they had a absolutely stonking ISA season. Business has grown hugely and was really ready to take a big chunk of money from us and Schroders and accelerate. So there's probably been a preamble. But now you're at the stage, you want to go off and raise a serious funding round. We have a chat, and it's probably an informal chat to start with, and you're getting to know me, I'm getting to know you. I'm trying to understand how fast is the business growing, what are the metrics that really count in this business, and what are they? And there's no sort of template for, I need these six numbers from you, and then I'll sort of put them in the black box number generator and tell you whether we invest. It really varies by business. So yeah, for a consumer thing, it'll be around retention and net promoter score, and for a marketplace business, it's all about the unit economics. It really varies. So we'll cover the high level then. And I'm trying to filter out probably 2/3 of the companies I see. I want to, after the first meeting, say no. Otherwise, I drown in too many first meetings. Then if we go deep, then I want to understand in more depth. I want to see all the metrics in the business. I want to meet the management team, and the entrepreneur wants to know more about me and about Balderson. I'll get them to meet one or two more of the partners here. And there's a sort of organic process of discovery. And what we desperately try to avoid is private equity style due diligence of kind of, here's our standard 3-page of bullet points of these are all the different bits of data we want to know, including kind of birth certificates for every major member of management. Yeah. So trying to be very staged and be careful of how we use the entrepreneur's time and how we use our time. There's always at the back of my mind is what's the next biggest question that would cause me to say no to this business and how do I get myself comfortable on it? So we go through that process. At some stage, I say, come in on a Monday, come to our investment meeting, and we'll, at the back of that, get a term sheet to you. So assuming it goes well, we have a vote. There's 8 partners. We all get 1 vote. We all vote out of 10. And if you get it's a complicated formula, but effectively 60% positive votes, then we will get you a term sheet, which will spell out the sort of the high-level terms of our investment. You're probably talking to some other investors as well. You'll hope that you get multiple term sheets, and then you can come back and negotiate a bit.
Just on that point, the earlier stage always assumes, and from their perspective, it's true that the power alliance of the VC, which it kind of does at that stage, if you're not particularly anybody, it's very hard to get a sort of good date, as it were. But actually, then the situation changes in that if you're really sort of hot property,
exactly.
Then the power is the other way around, which is that in a sense, the VCs are bidding for you.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen so often, but it can happen.
No, very much so. I've had done a recent deal, and it's a very interesting flip that happens. I think what you're trying to do as a VC, and I personally don't do well enough, is to make that less of a flip, that you are subtly selling yourself through the process so you don't have to suddenly sort of go into sell mode having been a kind of a difficult bastard all the way
up until then. Having kicked the crap out of them and suddenly say, now let me tell you why we're such nice people. There's a bit of a cognitive dissonance going on here.
Definitely that's my one thing I'm working on at the moment. Yeah, I think, look, the VC market has got a lot more competitive than it was 5 years ago, which is great for entrepreneurs and does mean there's more chasing. There's a lot more deals that get done now off market. There's companies that weren't thinking of raising, but there's a VC absolutely chases after them, starts throwing money at them.
Which turns their head.
They turn their head and then, yeah, they might sort of go out with a very short time fuse to a few other VCs just to make sure they're getting a fair offer, and that's roughly market rate. But yeah, we're seeing a lot more of that VC chase startup rather than the reverse.
Right. Okay. So at this point, you're on my wonderful board. And then how in practice does it work? I've seen you're generally called an observer on a number of boards. I mean, how does all this sort of added value work? You know, introductions and helping me and taking me for beers and introducing me to people and, you know, beating me up when I'm saying, oh, yes, user numbers have doubled every day for the last 10 years. And you say, no, doubling isn't enough.
I'd take doubling every day, even every year. So one important thing about us is we are 8 equal partners. So everyone is equally invested in every company. And so you don't just get one of us, you get us as a team. And I think that's really important because I think I'm pretty good on the strategic questions, asking tough questions. I spend quite a lot of time looking at marketing topics, and so I can be pretty helpful on that side. When it comes to partnerships, my partner Lars used to do partnerships for Uber, for Dropbox. He's the guy to ask about partnerships. When it comes to capital markets, then my partner Tim, who spent 20 years at Goldman Sachs, he's the guy to ask about anything capital markets related. So trying to bring them in as and when for the right pieces of advice. And I think there's 2 ways we get involved as a VC, right? One is the pull from the entrepreneur. It's like, I'd like to know more about Facebook marketing. What can you tell me? And then who else in your portfolio really knows Facebook marketing and can really help me understand that? And we have, the most important asset we have on that is 50-odd portfolio companies, 10 of which are in fintech, that are some of the smartest minds out there that you can sort of pull in as and when. We have a head of talent, we have a head of comms, so we have that kind of, we have legal and financial teams who can give that kind of very concrete support. But I think the second equally important part of a VC is being the person asking difficult questions. And when the business is going really well and we're growing really fast, to say, but actually, where are we on our cash collections? And I hate to be boring, but all of these clients aren't actually paying us any money. So yeah, trying to sort of think ahead to what are the things we've observed in our sort of prior lives and across other portfolio companies and what can go wrong, anticipating that and making sure that the company is ready for it.
So that's a very clear explanation, and it should be obvious to listeners what the difference is between money and smart money. Smart money coming with all these value adds you mentioned, with all these people who actually can help teach you stuff. as well as just wait for you to make the billion. And as you say, that, you know, in the case of someone like Balderton that's got some significant investments and significant players, it makes it sound like almost a little bit of a club. It's a private members club, mm-hmm. and there's someone else in your private members club that you can go to and say, oh, I'm getting a bit stuck in Scandinavia, isn't it?
Yeah, can you have something there? In common, yeah.
So time flows by as it always does. Is there any final note you want to leave us with Balderton Capital, Robert? And in particular, what kind of people do you want to hear from? And in particular, you don't want to hear from 1,000 people saying, oh, I've got a great idea, it's going to destroy banking overnight, can I have some money? Which presumably you get all the time.
I think what we're looking for is entrepreneurs who've got an original idea or an original twist, who've launched something, who've made something happen. There's a product out there that is tangible and that want to go for the big goal. They really want to go big, go global, and that's where we can be most help. And we are the leading VC focused on early stage investing in Europe. We have the biggest team of partners focused on that, and fintech is a particular strength for us. So we're really keen to make more investments in the fintech and insurance areas and across the whole tech spectrum over the coming years.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that, Rob. It's been a very clear exposition. Time's flown by. And thank you for being man enough to turn up and actually just tell the truth about, well, it is like this, but actually this is how it works and that's how it works. And hopefully listeners have got a clear idea about how a good firm that I'm told reliably by your investee companies is a good firm works and how that fits into the whole thing. And I wish you and all your investments every success in the future. So thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper. We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the fire.